For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.
To another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is writer-director Harry Mitchell. Hello.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. We've come to talk about your new film, Say Your Prayers, which is out now.
So, who wants to start?
Well, I made a mistake.
Yeah, you did, didn't you? Oh, no, the big mistake. How do you suggest we fix this rather big mistake?
The Ilkley Literature Festival, culminating this Sunday with the controversial secularist
Professor Bill Huxley.
We killed the wrong one.
My book deals with rational thought. You don't see me burning effigies of Christ.
Well, you look just like him from behind.
Yeah, but everybody looks like everybody from behind.
Detective Inspector Broff, I want suspension of all festival events for the next 48 hours.
It's the biggest weekend in the bloody calendar.
Yes, Martin, and there's been a bloody murder less than a bloody mile away.
You're not the average festival goer, are you? What are you really doing here?
I don't want to go to prison.
Probably the saints went to prison. Didn't do them any harm, did it?
This time we must be certain, absolutely certain. There's no room for error. We shan't bite our tongues anymore. We shan't let them laugh at us, humiliate us.
It's thoroughly enjoyable in all the right places and all the right reasons. We'll go into that in a bit. But before we do, do you want to give people a brief synopsis as to what Say Your Prayers is all about?
It's a black comedy about two brothers who, for one reason or another, have ended up becoming quite radical Christian fundamentalists. And they've been tasked with going to a literature festival in the middle of Yorkshire to try and assassinate a sort of infamous secularist academic. And we meet them killing the wrong guy, and the film kind of begins from there.
Mm. No, it is. It's a brilliant cold opening. I loved it. I tweeted about it after I watched it. It was, I said that it had shades of like Sightseers meets Kill List was my immediate thought about your film. So, those are two touchstones I enjoy. So the idea of combining them is always going to be enjoyable to my mind.
Well, that's a huge compliment. That's a huge compliment, you know, to ever, you know, make anything that reminds people of something like Kill List or Sightseers, yeah, it's a huge compliment. Thank you.
You and Jamie Fraser wrote this.
Yeah.
And is that a co-write, or is that he wrote and you directed and then as the director got involved in the writing, or was you writing it together?
We were writing it together. Jamie and I both did comedy. Jamie, I think, still does comedy. I don't do comedy anymore. So we met each other that way, and I floated a very early idea that would eventually become the film to Jamie, and so then we started working on it together.
So okay then, so that's good then. So my question, that's leading to the question of, so what was the kernel then that sort of gave birth to what has become the film Say Your Prayer? Because it is radical.
It was. yeah. Well, it came from a few places actually. It came. What was the initial kernel? I think the initial kernel was I was re-watching a Vida film, Ashes and Diamonds.
I don't know that one.
Which it's I think is second in the trilogy. I can't remember the name of the trilogy. Anyway, it's a film about two hitmen, and it was. I'd gone to see it at the BFI because it was part of the Scorsese had done a season at the BFI of some of his most influential movies. And Ashes and Diamonds was one of them. And I loved it the first time I saw it. So I went to go see it again. It's a wonderful film. You can see its influence in so many other great movies, you know, in Leon the Professional, in any real kind of hitman duo, whether it be in Bruges or Pulp Fiction or whatever. And I saw that and I started to think about a British comedic version of some of those elements in that movie. And then I got to think about the idea of a character who is a hitman, whose job it is to kill people, but who in his personal life really likes chin-wagging with people. It's his favorite thing to do. And it was just that as a comedic beat, and I took that to Jamie, and then we started to go from there really, and ask ourselves questions like, why would people be charged to kill someone in this day and age, and what ideologies would they be attached to or attracted to? And this is also 5 years ago now, 2015, when we started talking about. So that's, you know, that was pre-Trump. If you can imagine what life was like.
No, I can. No, it's like trying to imagine like pre-COVID.
Yeah, it's exactly right. But you know, that was a time that, you know, obviously we were starting to see political extremism and ideological extremism, but not to the extent that we have now. I think our conversations would have been quite different if we were making that film now. Anyway, essentially, we ended up on religion, and that's why we started talking about religion and making these guys religious fanatics.
I like the idea of the subverting expectations of a sort of the trope of the monolithic or even the sort of mute killer who says nothing but is very effective, to the indiscreet, always up for a chat. Actually, the killing's the last thing that's really on his mind. It's a really nice touch, that.
Yeah. I also just, I guess that was another point. A part of it was going, this guy doesn't want to kill. He has to kill. Why does he kill? But also, yeah, just, I think any character whose main thrust in life is just to, you know, be friendly and chat with people and be interested in people, I think is always going to be an endearing character. So to match that with, you know, a job ostensibly, which is to murder.
It's kind of the opposite. It's the opposite of a psychopath, isn't it, really? Somebody who's empathetic is the opposite of a psychopath, yet he's got a psychopathic profession. When you're writing this, what were the challenges in terms of, obviously, there's a dark comedy gives you a great scope, but equally there's kind of absurdity to dark comedy, but then there's also there's almost a drama as well, because I think the film makes some very serious points in and amongst all of the killing and the jokes and the japes. It's not just, ha-ha, isn't that absurd? It's actually, Jesus, that really is absurd if I sit back and think about it.
You know, it's tricky. My favourite films are always the ones that have light and shade and tread a line between drama and comedy. And I think they're my favourite because they reflect life.
But I think it's the what you do well is that it would have been easy to go, oh, church is bad, like as if that's a macro point that no one's ever considered. Whereas what you've done is you've created a character in Father Enoch who is just an evil bastard. It doesn't matter. He could be the manager of a football team, never mind the head of a church. And that would be he would have convinced two vulnerable people who could easily manipulated to do his bidding. You can imagine that. So it's kind of like the church bit gives you the easy understanding, but actually this is about evil people manipulating vulnerable people to do their bidding, which is a fairly serious point.
Totally. I mean, yeah. When it came to religion, I think that was something we were you know, wanted to be the most careful of, which was that we weren't just making a slightly lazy point, as you say, of just saying, well, all organized religion is bad. Mm. Because it's not. I can't remember who said it, but someone said there's no such thing as bad religions, just bad people, which I think speaks to the point that you were making. You know, there are people who would even argue with that, which is fair enough. But I think Jamie and I are both secularist or atheist, however you like to describe it. And so we wanted to work hard to ensure that what we weren't making was a sort of self-satisfied secularist pat yourself on the back, aren't we clever comedy. And actually, you know, it's been, for me, it was an incredibly interesting process, and one in which I've changed my, you know, only by a degree, but, you know, I've changed my views and my thoughts on organized religion. You know,
I know podcasts shouldn't be about the host, but I did do a kind of short film about trying to criticize religion. Me and the director, we set out with that goal, and we did a reading of the first draft. And obviously we're meant to be characters who are having doubt about their faith and stuff. And the first reading, the first question we got was, do either of you, not about this, they went, do you, either of you two believe in God? And we went, oh God, no. And they went, neither do your characters. And you're like, you realise that to be critical, you've actually got to still be considerate of what it means to have faith. You can't just go, aren't they daft? It's all imaginary. It doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, I totally agree. And also to, you know, I think the perspective I think it's interesting, having not grown up in a religious household, when I hit my teenage years, I very much became quite militant in terms of my atheism. And I think the reason for that was because I was desperately trying to find an identity. And so my atheism became my identity. And you know, I would enjoy thinking about how ridiculous it was to be a person of faith. I think I've reached the position now where I realize, you know, for me, as a secularist, by the same token, faith is a human creation that's been created to ensure civilization could exist, can exist, has existed. And to kind of poo-poo organized religion and poo-poo faith would be to undermine the vast amounts of incredible art, music, literature that's come from it and come out of it. You know, everything we do now particularly in the Western world, is influenced still heavily, whether we know it or not, by the Christian faith. So why, you know, why poo-poo that?
Now, your two hitmen are, one of them, obviously, for a lot of people with knowledge of Harry Potter, will recognise Harry Mellon as Tim. Me personally, I'd not seen Tom Brooke before, who plays Vic, and he was an absolute revelation to me. I think you that was some brilliant casting. There was genuine sibling rivalry on the screen, as far as I could tell.
No, but they, you know, they might as well be. They're both such fantastic actors. I mean, I know everyone says this, but we were so lucky to get those guys.
Just thinking of getting Harry in, how did you get? And obviously, he's the poster boy for the film. You know, in it's like, so what was the approach to him? Was that getting the script out and seeing if he likes, or was that talking about it? How was it?
Yeah, it was just that. We sent it out to him. I went for a coffee with him, and he said yes fairly quickly. I mean, Harry, everyone obviously knows Harry from the Harry Potter movies. He's had a fantastic career since then. But I think rarely, for screen anyway, rarely does he play the lead and take those leading parts, A. And B, I think he's often given, I think off the back of Dudley, he's often given, you know, either villainous characters or slightly less likable characters. And so I think for him, the double whammy of, you know, of being the lead in this film, but also playing a character who is ultimately incredibly likable, I think is what drew him. Part of what drew him to the project.
It's an odd role, that idea of a likable hitman, to say the least. I mean, that's good. But it never felt odd, if you know what I mean. I mean, watching it felt quite plausible. In obviously in the auspices of your film. But obviously, every time you're reminded that he's not really a killer, is he? He doesn't really dig this. And it's kind of like he just wants to go out and look. He obviously wants to like people. And that's, it's just such a, and he does it so well. I mean, that, like you described with the first instance where they sort of make their first error. And there's a whole exchange over a jam sandwich, which is as far removed from any hitman I've ever seen, you know, in a movie. But it's wonderful because it's a very human moment. It's, he knows he shouldn't. And then he does, and then it's like, wow.
Yeah. Well, he's just a guy who's, you know, best suited really to leaning over garden walls and asking people how their weekend was. That's, you know, that's where the character would be best placed. And unfortunately, he's also a product of his environment and is being told this is the right thing to do. This is the way you need to behave, and he thinks, okay, well, I suppose that makes sense.
Now, me kill this reference, and this is one of my notes I made when I was watching it. Is I don't know whether you did it overtly or not, but the scene with the blasphemous guys in the outside the pub in the pub table, and he goes over and yes. threatens him, is the inverse of Neil Maskell in the hotel dining room where he threatens to ram the guitar down the guy's throat if he mentions Jesus again. I just thought it was really clever. I'm not sure whether you consciously were inverting that scene, but it felt like it was a little bit of that, where you've got the hero is the overtly Christian going, stop with the blasphemy. But obviously us knowing who he is, that's loaded like a gun because he literally could kill him.
Yeah, I really want to say, that was my intention. That was... I planned that all along. Unfortunately, this is the first time I've thought about that. You're so right. I saw Kill This when it came out. I don't think I've seen it again, but I, you know, obviously loved it at the time. And it undoubtedly would have had a kind of subconscious influence. But I can't say hand on heart that was an intentional. Subversion.
Happy accidents are always good, but it's nice. Like I say, it's nice to get. It was nice being able to fit it in the canon, and given the complete inverse nature of the religious zealot being the one who's the aggressor, it's quite nice. Now, DCI Bro, is it Bro or Bruff? How do I say?
Bruff.
Bruff is a fairly hard-boiled and cynical character, to say the least. Where did the idea of slotting that into your story come from? Because it would have been very easy just to kind of be very procedural. But you've actually heightened that character in and amongst all the absurdity.
Yeah, well, we wanted to have a slightly comedic B plot going on. It's also a nice trick to have if you found yourself in a darker moment and you want to inject it with a form of levity. So we started working on this Bruff character, and she kind of exists in a slightly different movie, and we kind of were happy with that. We kind of embraced that. We kind of liked the idea that there were actually kind of three different movies going on, three different worlds going on, and they were all colliding slightly stylistically in the same way that you have all of these characters who represent these different ideas, and they're all colliding slightly, they're all colliding. And so Bruff was born out of that, and we wanted to have the slightly archetypal, gruff-talking, slightly corrupt detective figure. We wanted her to be a woman because we've seen that character before, sure, but time and time again we see it with blokes, and we didn't want her to change at the end. We didn't want her to, you know, to go through some big story arc and then come out the other side a different, changed person. She was who she was. She begins as she is, and she ends as she is, and that's what
she's wanted. That wonderful combination in my head of like the trope that you're used to seeing, which is the big city cop come to the small town, but in fact, in reality, she thinks she's that, but she's the girl that never left, and resents everyone around her because she's never left, and that comes out in every interaction she has. It's a wonderful concoction.
Oh, I'm pleased you liked it. And Anna obviously brings...
Yeah, Anna, I should say Anna Maxwell-Martin plays the role. And she's from Yorkshire, isn't she? Is she from that neck of the woods?
She is, yeah. She's from Beverley.
Yeah, so she really went to the max on the... with the accent. It's not like it was convincing, it was genuine.
Yeah. Well, she was saying, when we first spoke about it, she was saying that, you know, she knows those women. She knows all of them. She sat in hair salons with those women as a kid. So she to draw from and really enjoyed doing it.
Going back to, like I said, my enjoyment of watching Tom Brooke play Vic, what was your, as a director, talking to him about that character, and obviously he's the guy that's obviously the most closest to what you think of as a hitman, but obviously he's still a brother of Tim, the character, and so they are a duo. What was your sort of directing instructions with him, or what was your conversations with him like about how to play Vic, and you know where to go to 11 and when to be, you know, bubbling around 3?
Yeah, well, the first thing to say is that when I was casting Vic, I wanted to cast someone who could have played Tim, and I've been a fan of Tom as an actor for years and years and years. He does loads of stage stuff, but he's also, you know, got a real good a brilliant CV for TV and film as well. He's been in you know The Boat That Rocked, he's in Sherlock, he's in Preacher, and he often plays slightly more Tim-like characters, you know, either slightly dimmer or slightly sweeter. And he's got that side to him and he plays that incredibly well. And so when we went out to him, I knew that he had that in his locker and he could bring that out if he wanted to. And he only brings it out once or twice in the movie, and it's very slight and subtle, but I think it's enough to... do the important thing of humanizing him as a character and stopping him from just being kind of, like you say, at 11 the whole time and just this rageful individual that we can't get a grasp on. And then in terms of the conversations that we were having, I think one of the first things he asked me was is this Basil Fawlty or is this Begbie? Yeah, and I think essentially what he meant was, are we laughing? Is this guy just a comedy character, or is he, you know, is he real? And obviously, it's the latter. He's a real human being. And so from that point, I think it's then Tom's job, which he does a brilliant job of doing, which is finding the reality in that character. And hopefully, once you're finding the reality in that character, then whether you're at 11 or 3, that's going to start to come instinctively.
The mark, as it were, Professor Huxley, in your... I don't know whether you could have actually got anyone who could be more like Christopher Hitchens if you tried in Roger Allam. I mean, it's almost like... I felt like if I closed my eyes, it just was, and he'd been reborn or something. I'm guessing that was like the easiest casting in the world in some senses.
Yeah. I mean, precisely, yeah. You think of... almost too dangerously close. You know, you don't want anyone to think that the character we were writing was specifically Hitchens, because it wasn't. But also, it's glorious to be able to get someone like Roger to agree to do the project and then go, great, do your own thing. Whatever you do, it's going to work.
Yeah, because I went in cold. You see, I didn't know anything. I didn't watch your trailer, and obviously I'd seen the artwork. But once I'd read the premise, I thought, well, I just need to watch this. And it'll happen. So then when he appears, I didn't know he was in it till he appears. And then he starts being Roger Allam. And it's like, fucking hell, it is Christopher Hitchens. It just felt, I was like, it was like a perfect moment. We're like, of course Roger Allam would be the guy. And is Huxley a reference to Brave New World? Are we coming in for that?
It's actually a reference to Aldous Huxley's grandfather.
Okay.
I'm going to get it wrong now. I think it's John Huxley. I think it's as Roger's character is in the film, who was a academic and pal of Darwin. And when the On the Origin of Species was published,
yeah,
and Darwin went to Ilkley just after it was published to go have a relapse.
Yeah.
Darwin sent it to three of his mates, and Huxley was one of them, to kind of, you know, essentially say, what do you make of this? Am I about to get annihilated? Am I about to have to, you know, move into the basement and never be seen again? Mm. And Huxley, of the three of them, was his biggest supporter and went on to be a kind of... I'm sure there'll be academics who tell me I've got entirely wrong, but from what I've read, went on to be a bigger supporter of the theory of evolution than Darwin himself. Went on to be more hardcore about the whole thing. Darwin, some would suggest, had a difficult relationship with his own theory, because he kind of was a man of faith, or you live back then, everyone's got faith, so. You know, he found it incredibly difficult to wrestle with his faith and his discoveries. Whereas I think Huxley was more like, "This is it. Here we go.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's run with
this. The future is over there. Let's go with it."
Yeah, yeah. So that's what the reference was.
Now, I've mentioned him already, but I want to talk about it specifically. I thought Derek Jacobi's performance as Father Enoch was something very special. He's not a major part of the film, but. He absolutely owns the moments that he's in. Now, you as a director, and I want to group Roger Allam into this. It's like, what are you able to learn working with such sort of masters of their craft when you're making a film with them? How does that rub off on you? And what indeed do you even say to them when you're going, "Well, look, Derek, can you do? I need what I need is, you know, is he still someone you can have a conversation with? Is it?"
I think part of the reason. Derek and Roger have such successful careers is because not only are they brilliant at what they do, but they are so, so easy to work with. I think that's part of their longevity. If you can be both brilliant and easy to work with and receptive to the director and what they think, then people are going to want to keep working with you, obviously, because what more can you ask for? I mean, obviously, from my perspective, I'm a relatively young director, and I was terrified. I mean, hopefully hiding it well, but absolutely terrified. You've got award-winning actors who are national treasures, and there's you, and you're thinking, what on earth am I going to say to them? What I can't say anything to them. But I think, hopefully, what I found anyway, that once you're on set, you realise, okay, I do have a way that I see this, and a way that I'd like to try and put this together in the edit. And so you can, you know, if you have little notes, it's very rarely about the acting itself. It's more to do with, you know, could you try it like this, because it would help with this. And like I say, every time, with Derek, you give him a note and he goes, "Yes, of course." And then you see him and he thinks about it. And then you do it and he just delivers your note, but perfectly. But you know, he makes it his own and delivers the performance where you go, "Well, he's done my note, but he's also made it 10 times better." And also I will say that, that the one time I gave him a bum note, he said, "Yes, absolutely, he did it." And I could tell that it was a bum note, because it wasn't going to be him. It wasn't going to be him doing it wrong. It was going to be my note.
Really? So, you could see that so starkly?
Yeah, yeah. I could see, because, yeah, I could just go, I could literally see, yeah, that's my note that's done that. And so I went up and said,
"What in particular do you think he was able to bring to the character?" Sort of when you think about what you had on the page, and then suddenly he's performing Father Enoch. What little bits did you see come out of it? You were like, "Oh, I wasn't expecting that, but I like it."
I mean, he's got an innate ability to be incredibly charming, you know, and he's played incredibly charming characters throughout his career, as well as slightly more villainous ones. So being able to just turn that on when he needs to turn it on is, you know, it puts a tingle down your spine immediately. I mean, he brings everything. He brings an innate intelligence that I don't think can necessarily be acted, and it does what you always want to happen with your writing, which is that it makes it sound really good.
It's an interesting choice of word, that, because I think intelligence over experience is not the same. You can be experienced and still not be intelligent, can't you? I suppose is what you're saying. It's like he's considering the moment as much as he's considering I am an experienced actor.
Totally, yeah. And he brings everything to the role. You know, it wasn't just a holiday. It wasn't just a kind of, you know, because I think we only had, I think it would have only been like 4 days with Derek or something. But he came and he brought everything to it. And he also knew his lines down to a T, and he had a lot of lines and he had a lot of scripture that he had to learn. And, you know, I've done a bit of acting and with far less lines and get it wrong all the time. But he didn't fluff once, you know, having to do it again and again and again. And all of those things. I mean, I know, and I feel like it's slightly undermining Derek Jacobi by saying, oh, he was good at learning his lines. But I just mean, like, he was not only brilliant, but a consummate professional. And I think those two things go hand in hand.
But I think a message for the people who might be listening who are aspiring actors is that that's not to be underestimated as part of the job, because it's all hard enough as it is. So the more you can control, which is learning lines, that's not exactly uncontrollable, is it? Is the easier you make the harder variables to deliver. You use a male choir motif, which in the opening sequence is a tad sort of absurd and surreal, but actually it becomes a motif that lives throughout the whole film and is a reflection, I think, mostly of Tim's mind, I think, is where we're going with it. It's not always just that, but essentially that seems to be part of its use.
Jesus Christ.
What did you just say?
My lady, my husband.
Make it up to you.
From a kind of screenwriter point of view, first, how does that look on the page? And two, where did that motif idea come from?
Well, from a screenwriter's perspective, you have to do a lot of the work beforehand, because you're essentially writing the score into your script. I mean, we didn't choose every song beforehand, but a lot of those songs that they sing were written into the script. You know, it says a chorus appears, they sing Pleasant and Delightful.
Okay.
Because that's, they're not always in situ, but when they are in situ, that's what happens. And I think particularly for that opening song, it was important, you know, because it is quite a left field idea. It was important for producers and actors and anyone who's reading the script for the first time to get an idea of really how we imagined that chorus to sound like and what we envisaged them being. So, you know, putting in an initial song was important. In terms of where they came from, they weren't in the first draft. So they weren't an initial idea. They were in the second draft.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was when they were put in the second draft that I thought, yeah, I'm really excited about this film. This has given it the edge I think it needs in order to make sense for me. Where did it come from? Sometimes I think when people talk about where ideas came from, I think they must just make them up, because I feel like there's so many ideas where I don't remember where they came from. I know for sure that that part of the reason we put them in there is. It goes back to what we were talking about before, which is that we didn't want this film to be a film that said God definitely doesn't exist, or to be purely from an atheist standpoint. We also definitely didn't want it to be a film that suggested that God did exist. But I think using this magical realist choir who are not overtly connected to any form of religion or spiritualism, or and could just be thought of more like a Greek chorus, I think allowed us to kind of just plant the notion of, hey, there's something else in our film. We don't know what that something else is. It might just be a bit of film, bit of interesting filmmaking, but there is something else. So that's kind of why we went with them in the end.
It's effective because you can. I think if it had just been that one moment, it'd have been a bit like, what was that for? Whereas it kind of echoes, and yeah, thinking about it more as we talk, it gives you that kind of reminder of the bigger picture. Like, there's beautiful music come out of religion that isn't necessarily about being religious or not. You can just enjoy a melody, and you can sing songs without really getting behind the meaning of them. I mean, Onward Christian totally. Soldiers. I'm not averse, and I'm not signing the film, but I've sung it a lot of times, but I've never meant one word of it yet.
No. It's a fun song.
On top of the literal element of including music, but it's such a beautiful image visually to sort of, again, say, like in the opening sequence, you've got this suited and smart male choir just perched on a hillside in the Yorkshire Dales. It's a really striking image, and then the voices, everything. You're like, whoa!
And I also love that it ties it into the location. You know, that was part of it as well. We wanted to get an actual Yorkshire based male voice choir, which is what we got. That's the male voice choir there. And that was all part of it.
Well, look, let's remind people then, Say Your Prayers is available now. And how can people see it?
I believe just on all of the usual streaming platforms. It's on Amazon, iTunes, Virgin, Sky, probably a couple more.
Thank you for giving us your time on the Britflix podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.